Welcome back. I'm Steve G. Jones, clinical hypnotherapist, your tour guide, your mentor, hopefully not your tormentor, as we progress through this knowledge of ultimate conversational hypnosis. Hopefully you're finding out now that the information is easy to digest. Just takes a little listening and maybe re-listening and then putting it to practice. And I want to encourage you at this point. You've been through a lot of modules, unless you skipped ahead to module 15, but you've been through a lot of modules. You've learned a lot of information. I want to encourage you to continue practicing all of it. That is the way that you're going to become a black belt in ultimate conversational hypnosis, by putting it all to work for you all the time, making a habit of greatness. That's what's going to lead to your success. So enjoy it, have fun with it, and congratulations for making it this far. Module 15. And in this module, we're going to look at negotiation. Now, negotiation, in my opinion, is nothing more than conversational hypnosis, if you're doing it right. Some people go into a negotiation and they think that they have something to say, and the other person has something to say, and they're going to kind of see where everything goes, and if it works out, fine, and if it doesn't work out, fine. That's a very, very non-productive way to look at negotiations. And if that has been your mindset in the past, then I want to invite you now to change the way you think from now on. Now, when I say negotiation, perhaps you think, I don't do any negotiation in my life, but of course you do. All of us do negotiating every day. You have to deal with people on a day-to-day basis. If you're going to have a meeting, when's the meeting going to happen? Is it going to happen at this time or that time? There's probably a negotiation involved. If you're going to meet someone for lunch, perhaps you have to negotiate where you're going to meet, when you're going to meet. I'll tell you what makes the difference between someone who's living life on their own terms and who is happy, and someone who's letting the world just occur for them. Difference is that the people who live life on their own terms and are happy have an idea of where they want to go. Now, we talked in a previous module about letting go of results. So, okay, Steve, you want me to let go of results at the same time you want me to know where I'm going? Well, make no mistake. When I say let go of results, I do not mean to imply at all that you don't have a plan, that you don't have somewhere you'd like to end up. What I mean is that you need to let go of being so caught up in that it works against you. You see, people can get so worked up about needing something to happen that they work against themselves. They start breaking down the structure as they're building it, because they're so nervous about it. They're such non-believers about it happening. So when I say let go of results, don't let go of your goal. Just let go of your over-attachment to them. Just like in the book Siddhartha. If you haven't read that book, you need to. He accomplishes his goals because he's not attached emotionally to the results. They just happen. Okay, so let's take a look at some solid techniques that you can use when you're negotiating your way through life. Now, most of these techniques are, in fact, designed for business. And we spent some time talking specifically about dating. So now we're going to talk specifically about business. Those are the two topics in conversational hypnosis that people want to know the most about. How can I get more love? And how can I get more money? Talked about love, now let's talk about money. But realize that all of these techniques can be used pretty much in any realm. I want you to have some outcomes in mind that are going to help you succeed when you negotiate. All right. First of all, there should be some profit involved. There should be some reason you're doing it in the first place. If there's nothing in it for you, why are you doing it? A negotiation kind of becomes an argument at some points. Why are you going to argue for something when you don't even know what that something is. So make sure you're going to profit in some way. Secondly, I want you to know as much as you can possibly know about everyone involved in the negotiation, in the business transaction. Who are the key players? If it's a one-on-one interaction, I want you to know as much as you can about that person. Number three, I want you to understand anything that might be very difficult to achieve in that interaction. For example, you have to know that the person can't pay $1 million for your property, or that the car dealer can't give you the car for $1. Sure, they could, but they're not going to, and you know that. So understand the constraints that revolve around any situation that has to do with negotiating. Also, find out, if you can, where the absolute limits are, meaning the lower limits, the bottom line. What is the bottom line? If you're going in to buy a car, do some research, find out how low they can go, and then you can work toward that. Okay, with those ideas in mind, you should be well on your way to negotiating with power. But those are just a basic groundwork, just a basic framework, just a basic structure from which to work. There are a lot of other things to consider as well. For example, you need to prepare. Yes, you're going to use the techniques that I gave you in the first few modules about analog marking and pacing and leading. And I don't want to repeat those principles, so if you need to review those, go back and use them, because as I said during those modules, they can be used for sales. But you also want to have some good, sound knowledge. You want to make sure that you are prepared for this. You want to make sure that you have studied and done your homework and that you understand what's actually going on. Okay. Now, there are factors which can help you in any negotiation. One of those factors is that a lot of times people don't come prepared for a negotiation. They just walk into it and they're shooting from the hip. You need to take advantage of that and make sure that you are prepared. Beyond any little technique or trick that you can use, make sure you've done your homework. Make sure that you have prepared for the negotiation by doing everything that you can. Okay, what about some techniques you can use in the actual negotiation itself? Well, first of all, I want you to control the pace of the negotiation. I want you to take charge. If you're rushing, if you're hurrying, if you're trying to get things done too quickly, if you're giving in to their deadlines, you're losing control. As we'll see in a little bit, the only deadlines that you create are the deadlines that cause the other side an inconvenience, that cause the other side to have to do things quickly to accommodate you. So you want to make sure that you are in charge of the pace. The speed at which the negotiation progresses is dictated by you. Now, it doesn't mean that you should always drag your heels and go slowly, but realize that you need to control the pace. You need to take it easy, make sure that you understand everything, and don't give in to deadlines imposed by the other side, unless they're absolutely mandatory. Okay, so how do you, in a negotiation, take charge of the pace? Well, first of all, any offer that comes at you right away, you don't accept. Don't accept that. I had a very simple version of this recently. I had a freezer that I was trying to buy from a hardware store. I won't name the store. A big chain. Anyway, it arrived damaged, and I sent it back. And though I thought I had sent it back, they actually didn't come to pick it up. A lot of calls went back and forth. I had my assistant dealing with this, but I was still hearing a lot of the calls back and forth. Come pick it up. Okay, we'll pick it up. They didn't pick it up. They're going to pick it up next Wednesday. They didn't pick it up. Finally, I got on the phone, and I said, what are we going to do about this? And in their negotiation, in fact, they had a whole department dedicated to that. I don't remember what they called it, but it was something along the lines of customer resolution or something like that. These were people trained in negotiations to satisfy the customer. And they said, how about Mr. Jones will give you a $50 gift certificate? And I said, how about you'll give me a $100 gift certificate? And they said, fine. Don't accept any offer right away. If someone concedes right away in a negotiation, don't accept that. Always pause or tell them you're going to think about it or raise the offer. You lose your power if you concede right away. That's what they want you to do. Being indecisive can work against you. You want to avoid that. However, if you're indecisive in the right way, you can use it to control the pace, the speed at which the negotiation is moving along. If someone says to you that they'll offer you $50, or let's raise the stakes, let's say it's $500,000 for a large piece of real estate you bought and something wasn't quite right, they're offering you $500,000 to make up for it. That's a lot of money, but they offered it right away. Being indecisive here, or seeming to be indecisive, can really help you. I'll think about it. I'll get back to you. Let's take a look at deadlines. Now, deadlines are not good if you have to live up to the deadline. But if the other person has to live up to the deadline and you don't, that can be good. If someone imposes a deadline on you, for example, you have to sign by next Friday. You have to sign this real estate transaction or buy this car or whatever it is. You have to do it by a certain time. I want you to test that. I want you to test that deadline. The deadline is something that could be made up. And by the way, you may be making up deadlines for them from time to time. I'm not in favor of lying, but if you create a deadline and you say it's a deadline, then it is a deadline. So test their deadlines. My boss, I just spoke to him, and he said, you can have this car for only $75,000, down from the normal $120,000, if you sign right now. Oh, really? Well, I didn't bring my checkbook, or I have to talk with my wife, or I have to catch a flight to New York in an hour. I'm going to have to come back in 2 days to do this. Oh, okay, well, that will be fine. Okay, so if that happens, you have tested the deadline and you've been successful. You've successfully found out that that deadline doesn't actually exist. So when a deadline happens, always test it. Now, it could go the other way. You could say, well, I can come back in 2 days and do this. And they might say, well, I'm sorry, this offer won't be available. In which case, you might want to reconsider it. But deadlines should be tested when they're imposed by the other side. Okay, delays. Sometimes when you're negotiating, there are going to be delays, and they happen, and that's just the way it is. What if you're on the selling side? What if you're the seller? What if you're selling cars? Let's make you a used car salesperson, for example. And we're on the other side of the coin now, and the customer is delaying. Well, you have to give them some kind of incentive to get them moving. And the problem with delays is that car salespeople know this. Delays often turn into a no sale. In most cases, if someone has 24 hours to think about it, they will talk themselves out of it, or that short delay will become a longer delay. You may notice, especially if you're a car salesperson yourself, that cars are sold that day. That's when most of the sales happen. If the person has 24 hours to think about it, That 24 hours can go to 1 week, 1 month, and the rest of their lives. They may never buy the car. So car salespeople, if you are one, close the deal that day. Of course, you know that. If you're not one, but you're dealing with one, realize they're going to create this motivation for you. But let's get back to you being the salesperson. Let's have fun with this. You're a salesperson. You're a car salesperson. And the person wants 24 hours to decide. All you simply do is say that this offer is going to be revoked. This offer is not going to be around. This is a one-time offer. You need to act now. You're going to do a couple things. Number one, you're going to cause the person to buy, but you're also going to do the person a favor because that person really does want to get whatever it is, the car, the house, whatever it is. So you're helping them by getting them off the fence, giving them that push, giving them that incentive to buy. Okay, here's another principle, and this could be selling anything. You're selling yourself as a person, the idea of you as a great person, or you're selling a product or an idea or whatever it is. People want what they either can't have or what somebody else wants. If they know that somebody else wants whatever it is, they are going to be more interested in it. They say one of the best ways to sell a piece of property is to put a sold sign on it. Then suddenly people are interested in it. If you are interested in selling something, you need to have it at least appear that lots of people want it, that it's very sought after, that there are a lot of bidders, and so forth. People think that when a man wears a wedding ring, it's going to scare off potential women who might want to be with that man. Well, and you can lump this in with the dating information, that's not the case. When women see a ring on a man's finger, in many cases, or a rock on a woman's finger, in many cases, they realize, wait a minute, somebody wanted that person. Somebody thinks that person is valuable. At least one other person in the world thinks that. Maybe I should think that too. So keep that in mind. People want what they can't have or what somebody else wants. What else can we learn about negotiations? Well, pretending that you don't really know what's going on is going to do you a world of good. If you go in there and lay out all your expertise on the table and tell everyone that you know everything about everything, that could potentially work against you. By kind of dumbing it down a little bit, as I say, you go in under the radar. You cause them to give out information that they probably shouldn't give out because they don't think that you're smart enough to do anything with it. So acting like you don't really know a lot about what's going on can actually help you. You're hiding your secret weapons. You're hiding the fact that you are sharp as a tack. They don't know that. You know, one story I heard one time when I was at a sales seminar, and I was invited to give a talk there. One of the speakers before me was telling a story, and he talked about a person who was involved in real estate. I believe the person he talked about was Sol Goldman. And Mr. Goldman was an interesting negotiator, apparently. He was going to buy a property for a certain amount of money, and he had decided he was going to pay that amount of money. He walked into the negotiation where they were going to talk about and finalize the deal. And by saying, "What?" several times in a row, he was able to get the price lowered. He acted as if he didn't think the price was appropriate, as if he was shocked by the price. Each time he did that, the price went down a little bit. So when he finally was at the end of the negotiation, the person selling the property didn't even realize that there was a negotiation going on. They just thought they were insulting Mr. Goldman with each of these prices, even though each time the person was offering a lower price or throwing in a freebie. And Mr. Goldman's response each time was simply, "What?" He was acting shocked at that price. And that's how he got what he wanted. He ended up saving, I believe it was $1 million or something like that, and getting some kind of bonuses. But believe it or not, that tactic can work. And you can call it dumbing down or whatever you want to call it, but it works in negotiations. All right, let's look at other techniques that work really well in business dealings, which, of course, you understand can be applied to other areas of life. People love getting something free. When the person was negotiating with Mr. Goldman and gave him something free, this person realized that one of the incentives that causes people to want to go ahead and sign is getting something free. And of course, that was Mr. Goldman's whole goal, to get something free and to get the price lower. So if there's something that you can throw in free, which won't cost you much anyway, go ahead and do that. Go ahead and sweeten the deal, incentivize the person by throwing in something free. I think you'll find that it's, first of all, an expression of goodwill. You're showing that you're a good person and willing to give something. Secondly, you're going to find that you get that much closer to closing the deal because people are very interested in having something free. Admitting your mistakes, admitting when you're wrong, admitting when you've messed up. You may think in a negotiation that using your conversational hypnosis techniques and feeling like an expert and then admitting when you've made a mistake, not in conversational hypnosis because you're not even going to acknowledge that you're using that, but I mean making a mistake in your facts or figures or what have you. You may think that admitting that mistake is going to somehow weaken your stance, when in fact it's not. When people mess up, when they make mistakes, it makes them appear human. Humans like to deal with humans. They like to understand that the person they're dealing with is not only human, but also an honest human, a person who can make mistakes and own those mistakes. So if you're making mistakes constantly, I don't want you to own every one of them, but I do want you to occasionally, when you make a mistake, we all do, own up to it and say, "I made a mistake. I'm sorry, and here is the correction." Deadlines. You want to impose a deadline if you can. Imposing a deadline is a wonderful idea if people think something is time sensitive. However, I want you to keep this other factor in mind, that the more time people put into something, the more they become invested in it, the more it becomes a part of who they are, the more it becomes something that they really want to have happen. So, if you can spend a little longer with someone than you wanted to in a negotiation, I think what you're going to find is that they're not going to want to let go of the results. They're going to want to find a way to make this happen. I myself was caught up in this recently, and I had to see through what was going on. I was getting so caught up in buying a condo. I wanted to get this condo and turn it into a vacation rental and make a profit off of it. And I happened to enjoy buying real estate. And I was so caught up in this, and there were so many little things coming my way, being thrown in by the bank. Oh, you have to pay an extra $8,000 for this. Oh, you have to pay an extra $120,000 for this. Oh, you have to do this and do that, and all these little concessions. Well, they're happening, and they were being revealed to me one at a time over the course of about a week. And I was getting more and more caught up in this every day, thinking, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to close this deal. I'm Steve G. Jones. I can get the best deal on anything. Well, it was starting to work against me because I was so caught up in it. I had invested so much time into this that no matter what happened, I wanted the deal to work out, and I was willing to make some ridiculous concessions. Finally, When I realized what was going on, I just laughed to myself. And I told my realtor, we need to get out of this. We need to end this. But keep in mind, it is human nature that the more time you put into something, the more you want to stay in it. Think about relationships. The more time people are married, the more they think that they owe it to the marriage to keep it going. It can be the worst, most abusive, least productive marriage in the world, yet people will fight for it. Why is that? Because they put 18 years into it and they don't want to give it up. Or it's for the children. Have you heard that one? Throwing plates and spoons and forks and knives and whatever at each other. Well, these people are not staying together for the children or for each other. They're staying together out of bullheaded stubbornness because they are caught up in the psychological effect of time investment. The more time you put into something, the more you want to see it work out, even when it's ridiculous. So realize in any negotiation, if you can see through that, if you can rise above that, if you can transcend that concept to where you're above it and looking down on it and seeing how people get caught up in it, then you can take charge. You won't be jerked around by that concept. You'll be able to watch other people jerk themselves around with that concept. They get so caught up in negotiating for so long that they have to make this happen. Well, that's fine. I'm going to then put in some terms that work for me just so we can close this deal. Another important factor that really helps when you're negotiating is to get as much information as you can from outside sources. You're going to be more powerful in your conversation if you have outside source information, meaning information that has to do with what's going on, but it's information that the other people don't have. The other side doesn't have this. So make sure you know all the facts that they know, and then make sure you know some that they don't know. What about when you don't know something? You go into a negotiation and you don't know something. You think that the other person is going to just let that pass and think you're a wonderful person for not knowing that. There's a time to act dumb, and there's a time to hide that dumbness. If you're actually not informed about something, well, that puts you in the dumb situation. And that's fine. Not everyone knows everything. We're all dumb in some areas, or the word wouldn't exist. So if you're there and you have a gap in your knowledge, own it to yourself. Own up to it. I don't know this. But if it's a critical point and you're in negotiation and everything's working fine, and suddenly they mention something that you should know about and you don't, well, you don't want to own up to not knowing about it. For example, when I was in my early days of buying real estate, somebody was trying to sell me, I believe it was another condominium earlier on, and they said to me, you cannot get this condo and expect to get a CO. I didn't know what a CO was, and the internet didn't exist yet, so I couldn't just type it in, a CO. And I tried to look up CO in my dictionary, but there's no CO in the dictionary. I didn't know what a certificate of occupation was. I also didn't know what the implications were. The implications were that without the CO, you can't actually live there or have anyone else live there. So I was at a disadvantage. But in this negotiation, I just said, of course, I understand that. If you play it off as if there's not a gap in your knowledge, you're going to gain some power. Most people will not call you on this. They're not going to say, can you then explain to me what a CO is, since you said, of course. Conversations don't work like that. People are going to assume that you have certain knowledge. Just play along with that assumption. I think you're going to find that this works in many situations. If you find that people are assuming that you know something or that you are something or what have you, then you can simply play along with that and go along with that. For example, and not to pick on anyone else, but there are a lot of hypnotherapists out there who don't actually have legitimate degrees. I'm happy to say that I do, and I'm going to push for legislation that does require hypnotherapists to have legitimate university degrees. Most people assume that hypnotherapists do have some sort of degrees. I encourage you to check into that, because what you're going to find is that that's not always the case. So some hypnotherapists have banked on that in the past, that assumption, and it's worked for them. If there is a gap in your knowledge and the other person assumes that there is no gap, let them have that assumption. If someone has a story in their mind about you and you're seeing it unravel in their conversation, as long as it's a good story, let them run with it. Oh, I'm sure you were the head of this and the head of that, and you can just nod your head. Why do you want to rewrite that story when it's working for you? You never told them that story. They assumed that they made it up in their heads. So the appearance of knowledge can go a long way. You're not having to create fictitious information. You're just letting them run with their story. And everyone makes up a story about you, you're going to find. If you start paying attention to it, your neighbors, you may think that they know exactly who you are and what you do. I think you would be shocked if you surveyed them, five of them, and asked them key questions about what you do, what your interests are, and what your overall outlook on life is. Because people will make up stories based on people who are similar to you, based on people who do similar things to those things that you do. So this appearance concept can have many implications. Go for it. Just let them run with it. You need, of course, to use the other techniques that I've mentioned in other parts of this program. You need to make sure you're anchoring yourself for confidence and firing off that anchor before you go in. You need to make sure that you're anchoring the other people to believing that you're honest and motivated and so forth by touching your chest area when you say those words. You need to use all of those techniques. You need to pace them. You need to lead them. We're not going to review all of those things, but you understand, of course, they apply here. And if you need to brush up on them, please do so with the solid information that I gave you in those modules. Because I want you to understand that you can have all the knowledge and preparation in the world, but if you get nervous, you can start to make mistakes. So I want to make sure that you are prepared. You have hopefully prepared yourself with hypnosis ahead of time, at least the night before, and you've anchored yourself for strong, solid success. Well, here's another technique that I haven't taught you yet that really works well when you're talking to a group. And I use this technique myself. I was talking to a radio station in Los Angeles, and I was going to train their staff on how to use NLP to be successful, how to use it in sales success. Little did they know, I guess they do now, but little did they know that I was using NLP on them to get the sale. Now, I had to be a little clever, more so than usual, because the sales director was sitting directly across from me in the large boardroom at the end of this large boardroom table, and all the staff was there. My job as someone who was invited to talk to them was to convince them that I knew what I was talking about and I could train them to be better salespeople. Well, I've done this in countless locations around the world, and I've done this with countless car sales places. So I knew what I was doing, and I know what they know. I know they have a little bit of conversational hypnosis information, but they don't have everything. What I did, and I want to share this simple technique with you because I think you'll gain a lot of mileage out of it. Rather than doing any of the usual anchoring in front of them, anchoring myself by touching myself, I thought that they would be wise to that, so I avoided that. Instead, what I did was I had the contract on the table, the contract that they would sign for thousands of dollars to have me train their staff. Now, I know that I know what I'm talking about, but they didn't know that. That was years ago. It was before I had the reputation that I have today. I had to do some convincing. I knew I had the steak, but I needed the sizzle to sell the steak. So what I did was I had the contract on the table. I made sure that they knew that that was the contract. And I just kept saying the word good deal. I would say, I know that you all are after a good deal. And I would point to the contract when I did that. Or I would put my hand on the contract when I did that, but not in an obvious way. You see, the contract was on the table. And when I said good deal, I'd put my hand on it and lean in over the desk as if I was just using the contract to balance myself. You see how subtle that is? I also had a pen on top of the contract. That was another way that I could anchor them to believing the contract was a good deal. When I said, I know that you all expect a good deal, I reached down and picked up my pen from the contract. Do you see how that brought motion, that brought forward kinesthetic motion to the contract? And as I picked up my pen, my hand was touching the contract. Well, needless to say, everything worked out fine. But the point is that you can find creative and subtle ways to anchor things. You want to anchor yourself for success before you go in by firing off your anchor. If they're not wise about NLP, you can anchor them to you by touching your chest when you say certain keywords. But you can also anchor certain things to concepts, anchoring the contract to the concept of good idea. That is a good idea. Also, of course, you want to use analog marking. What would be a good analog marking sentence for these people? What do I want them to do? I want them to sign this contract. If you remember from our module on analog marking, when we use that, when we use embedded commands, we come up with a three-word command, ideally. If you have to, you can come up with four or five words if you need more words to describe it. But ideally, you would have a three-word command, sign this contract. My challenge then was to deliver a sentence or paragraph to them with those words said a little more loudly than the rest. Or, if you remember from that module, I could make an eye movement while I'm saying those words. While I'm saying the word sign, my eyes move in a certain way. While I'm saying the word this, my eyes move in a certain way. And while I'm saying the word contract, my eyes move in a certain way. Or I can make a certain gesture while I'm saying those words, but only those words. When I'm saying the word sign, I can scratch my head, and then my hand goes back down. When I'm saying this, I can scratch my head, my hand goes back down. When I'm saying the word contract, I can scratch my head, but then my hand goes back down. You see, there's something different going on while those words are being said. The simplest way, in my opinion, to do analog marking in person is to say the words a little more loudly than the rest. So, for example, I would create a sentence or paragraph which would have those words in it said a little more loudly. And it might sound something like this. I was driving here to give you all the presentation this morning, and I stopped at a stop sign, and this was this morning, and I started to think about how we can all come to terms with the contract that we discussed. So I've said, sign this contract to their subconscious minds. I said the words, sign this contract, a little more loudly than the rest. Okay, that's analog marking or embedded commands, and that's how you can use that in a sentence. But I could have them do anything I want. I could test them all by having them scratch their heads. I could use the embedded command for scratch your head. I could say something like, when cooking from scratch, it's best if your knowledge comes from a head chef. something like that. So I find an excuse to use those words. Now, you have to make sure it makes sense. If I'm talking about radio broadcasting to them, then I need to make sure that I'm talking about something that at least relates to me or them or radio broadcasting. If I'm talking about a chef, that's not going to make much sense. So you need to make sure that it's context specific, but then just go with it. Also, let's talk about suggestibility tests. The embedded command, when you do something like that, scratch your head, you can see who's suggestible, who in that boardroom is scratching their head, who's responding to it. We can also do other suggestibility tests to find out who is suggestible and who might actually be someone we can persuade to be on our side. Okay, so suggestibility tests that you can use with someone would be the following. The lemon test is a classic test. You describe cutting a lemon and biting into it, and you watch if people salivate. The only problem with that is that a lot of people know about the lemon test. You're describing cutting a lemon and biting into it, and you're just seeing who responds, who's licking their lips, who's swallowing, who is responding with increased saliva because you're talking about that. Well, you need to make sure that you are disguising it to make sure that nobody catches you doing this. So the way you would disguise the lemon test would be to say something in a sentence or a paragraph that makes sense in your context. You know, after we finish this meeting, I'm going to head across the street to get the salad, and they always serve it with a side of lemons, and I love just cutting those lemons and biting into them. Anyone here like lemons? And whether they raise their hands or not doesn't matter, because all you're looking for is who is salivating. Or who's responding? Who's making the sourpuss face? Oh, no. Oh, no. And you can see them physically responding. Or you can use phrases in your talk such as, don't you just hate it when teachers scratch their nails down a blackboard? Well, that's how I feel about high prices. Something like that. Watch as you do that. Don't turn your back from them. Watch them. Look at everyone while you're doing that. Who is grimacing? Who is creating an actual image of that in their minds? Now, if you are one of those people who responds to the nails scraping down the blackboard, you may think that everyone responds that way, but they don't. A person has to be able to really feel it kinesthetically, and sometimes auditorily they have to hear it, or sometimes visually they have to be able to see it. But no matter how they're responding to it, they're responding to it. Don't worry about determining why they respond. Just realize they do respond. Realize they're suggestible. So throw out a few of these suggestibility tests, and what I want you to do is watch for who is responding in every situation. It's possible that some people will respond in one situation, others will respond in a different situation. Who's responding consistently? I want you to use visual representations. As you talk about scraping your fingers down the blackboard, say something such as, I can just see my fifth grade teacher scraping her fingers down the chalkboard, and physically reach up and move your hand so they can see it. They can see the hand. Who's responding to that? And then you can say, I can just hear that screeching right now in my head. Who's responding to that? Who's more auditory versus visual? And then I could just feel that through my entire body. Well, who just shook? Who just got a little chill when you said that? Those are the kinesthetic people. So you can determine someone's representational system through a suggestibility test as well. And that is a great one to use. Make sure after you use that one in a meeting presentation that you separate yourself from it. Well, I want you to know that I'm no fan of scraping fingers down the chalkboard, and that is not what we're going to talk about here. I'm glad we agree that that's a negative thing. And then separate yourself from it and move on. Another thing that helps in negotiations is having an us and them. The them in this case is the sound and the sight and the feeling of the scraping nails down the chalkboard. You're separating yourself from that. Even though it doesn't actually exist, it's just a concept, you now have a them. It's like having a common enemy. Yeah, we hate that. In the 1950s, in the United States, it was the Russians, the common enemy. We could all unite, saying we didn't like them. Now we're more understanding of everyone. The world is coming together. People are understanding about world peace and so forth. But so many things have been accomplished by making a common enemy out of someone. We have an us and we have a them. You see it even in grade school, in playgrounds. There's an us, there's an our gang, and there's them. It unites the group. It solidifies the group. It's manipulative to say that those people over there are different or bad. It's not nice. It's not good. But it works. It's been used by governments to get things done. It's been used by sales teams to get things done. I work for this car company. That car company is bad. We're going to beat them. We're going to try hard and we're going to beat them. Well, that car company is not bad or good. They're just a car company. They sell cars. But by making them the bad guy, by making them the them, we've made a stronger team. Stronger team here. Just like any sports team. Sports teams are essentially all the same. They all wear the same type of uniform. They all try their hardest. And they all have a coach and players, or several coaches. They're essentially the same, yet they compete against each other, and they excel because they compete against each other. Having an us and them can be very powerful. It's been used against you a lot. You've been manipulated with this concept of us and them. Different countries, different companies, and so forth. But it works. It gets people motivated. Gets people to do things. Eventually, there might be another planet discovered with people, and it'll be us, planet Earth, against them. Hopefully, everyone will get along if that turns out to be the case. But you get the point. From the playground to the solar system to the galaxy, it's there, us and them. As I record this, I don't know of life on other planets, although I believe it could exist. But there are UFOs that people talk about. Even if life doesn't exist on other planets, which I don't know if it does or not, we believe it might. So there's an us, our planet, against this unknown them that can be used to unite people and motivate and manipulate and control. So realize this power. If you can create an us and them, you're going to have a more cohesive group. If I'm talking in front of that radio station and I'm saying that your radio station is more motivated, more fast-paced, more intelligent, or so forth than that other radio station, well, suddenly I've aligned myself with them. There's this team, and I know your radio station wants the best. And of course, right when I say the best, I'm pointing at myself. I'm touching my chest, right, when I'm saying the best. I've created the idea of us, and I'm included in the us. I've created the idea of them. We've got to beat them. Remember, them, it's always the bad guy. It's always the enemy. And I've anchored them to me being the best. I've done all that with one simple sentence. So realize the power you have. More along the lines of these suggestibility tests and determining the major modality. Auditory, visual, kinesthetic, their major modality, their major representational system. I want to talk more about that now. If you're using these suggestibility tests and you're using something auditory that gets a response, something visual that gets a response, and something kinesthetic that gets a response, notice who's responding to what. And most importantly, notice what the decision maker is responding to. You see, all of these people are probably just people who offer their opinions, but they don't sign contracts. There's one person who signs the contract. Make sure you're watching what he or she does. Which representational system are they responding to most? When I do the blackboard example, is it seeing the blackboard? Is it hearing the blackboard? Or is it feeling that uncomfortable feeling? Could be all of the above, but there's probably one that's more prevalent than the other three. there's a greater response from one of those representational systems. So keep an eye out. Once you have this knowledge, once you're holding it in your hand, you can then start using it. Review the module about the words to use when you have a visual person, about the words to use when you have an auditory person, about the words to use when you have a kinesthetic person. You can then start to manipulate them, control them, persuade them to get them to do what you want them to do. All right, let's look at some other information that will help us. Have you heard of the dead dog on the table technique? The dead dog on the table. This is a very powerful technique when negotiating with someone. The idea is that you're going to present something which you don't even want to have happen. For example, how about you sell me that piece of real estate at 50% off and you finance half of that at 2%. Something ridiculous. Something that you know they won't go for and you don't care about. You're making an offer. And this can be in interpersonal skills too. If you're negotiating interpersonally, you want me to take out the trash every night? Well, how about I'll let it pile up and I'll take it out once a week? Okay, that's your dead dog on the table offer. You have put something on the table which you don't believe in and you know they're not going to go for. If they do, that's great, but they're probably not going to go for it. And then you can back off of that offer. The idea is the next offer that you make is the one that you want them to take. Okay, you don't want me to let the trash pile up for a week and then take it out at the end of the week. How about I'll take it out 3 times a week rather than every night? Because it's cold out there and I don't want to go out every night, I'd rather take it out 3 nights a week. You see, that was your goal all along. And compared to the other offer, it sounds pretty good. You're going to let trash pile up in the house for a week? Can you imagine the flies and so forth and the overflowing trash? Something that you wouldn't even go for yourself. But that's your initial offer. Second offer is the one that you're actually after. So the first offer is a bad offer. It's something that if they take, fine, but they probably won't and you don't care. It's the dead dog on the table. The second one is the one you're after. It can happen in business. It can happen interpersonally. It can happen in dating. You can use this technique any way you want. Just to sidestep a little bit, go back into dating just to see how this information kind of crosses over, the sales and dating information. Here's an example of a dead dog tactic in dating. Why don't we go back to my place right now, and in the morning I'll cook you breakfast. That's a dead dog technique. If it works, great. You've solved the problem of getting this person to your home, haven't you? And you know that they're going to stay the night. But you don't exactly expect that to work out. The next offer would be, you're right. What we'll do is we'll have a few drinks, and then we'll just hang out at my place for a little while, and I'll have you back home by 3 a.m. That's an example of how to use the dead dog on the table technique. Here's another interesting technique that works really well, called the double bind. Very similar to the dead dog on the table, but the double bind technique is giving them two options, either yes or yes. In a business situation, it would work like this. Let's say you're negotiating with someone, and you're simply negotiating about the time to meet. They don't know that it's a negotiation yet, and really with the power you have, there's not going to be much of a negotiation because you're going to give them really an ultimatum. But they don't know that because most people won't see it coming. Here's how it works. You're going to make an appointment with somebody. You want them to be at that appointment. That's what you're going for. That's your goal. That's your outcome. You want them to have lunch with you. And this can be for dating, as you can see, or for business. So you'd say to them, would you like to meet for lunch Tuesday at 2 o'clock or Thursday at 4 o'clock? Do you see what the choices are there? The choices are yes, you will meet me for lunch, or yes, you will meet me for lunch. Because the only variables in there are the time and the date. Yes or no is not a variable. Eat lunch or don't eat lunch is not one of the variables. So you have taken out that variable, but you've been clever about it. It's called a double bind. You've got them either way. Once again, you would say something like, would you like to meet for lunch at 2 o'clock on Tuesday or 4 o'clock on Thursday? So either way, you're offering them lunch. Similar to the dead dog on the table technique, in that you're getting to your goal, but a slightly different approach to it. And it can be a lot of fun, because the first time you use it, you might think this person's going to see right through it, but they usually don't. They usually just go for it. When you go into any negotiation, it's important to have goals, and it's equally important to have a plan for during the negotiation. So you need to plan out certain things, and you need to know who you will be negotiating with. You need to plan out or know what you expect from the other person or the other group. What do you expect from them? The group you're working with, the group you're trying to convince, what do you expect from them? Where do you want to lead them? You need to plan out what you will do if things suddenly stop. If things come to a screeching halt, what are you going to do? Usually you can throw in one of your incentives. You can give away something that you plan on giving away anyway. You can raise your offer a little bit if you're buying, or lower it a little bit if you're selling. But you're still within your limits that you have predetermined. So you need to decide what you're willing to give to make it happen. Determine that ahead of time. That gives you power. How are you going to react each time they say something, each time they agree to something? And most importantly, what are you going to say? You've got to present this, so plan what you're going to say. And if you need to rehearse it, fine. Just don't sound like you've rehearsed it when you deliver the information to them. All right. Here's an interesting tactic that works very well when you're dealing with someone. Tell them they can do better. Is that your final offer? Is how you might phrase that. Or you can tell them, I think you can do better. I think you can do better than that offer you just made. Or, you must do better than that offer that you've just made. You can always blame it on someone else. Well, my boss is not going to accept that. I want to work with you here. And you're using your rapport. You're looking at them in the eyes. You're saying, let's work together. My boss isn't going to accept this. Let's think of something together that he will accept, or that she will accept. So it's a way to politely demand a better deal. Demand something. Now, on the other side of the coin, they may be trying to do the same thing to you. So the defense for that is to say, that is my bottom line. I have given all that I can give, or all that I'm authorized to give. That is my bottom line. If someone bottom lines you and says, that's all that I can do, then you want to look for other possibilities, other things that they can do, other things that they can give you. That's your price? Okay, fine, I respect that. What else can you throw in? Okay, I hope you've enjoyed this information about negotiating with sales. Remember, as with anything else, keep it simple, and I want you to make sure that you are prepared. Keep it simple, be prepared, and you'll be fine. All right, let's have a brief quiz to make sure that you understand the information. Believe it or not, you're absorbing a lot of information. You're listening to hours after hours of modules. At a certain point, I need to make sure that you're getting a quiz. So you've had a few breaks from quizzes. Now it's time for a little bit of a quiz to make sure that you're absorbing everything. And I'm only going to test you on this module. But let's take a look at some questions. Question number one, what is the most important goal to have in mind when entering any negotiation? Okay. And question number two, if you're doing the chalkboard suggestibility test, and someone shivers when you mention the sound that the fingers make while sliding down the chalkboard. A, what kind of representational system are they using? And B, what are some of the words? This is going back to a previous module now. What are some of the words? I told you I wouldn't test you on a previous module, but I want you to tap into that information at least. What are some of the words that you could use? What are some of the words you could use to manipulate that person? Okay, two-part question. If someone's reacting to the sound of the nails on the chalkboard, what kind of representational system is that person using? And what are some of the words that you can use to control them and manipulate them? All right. That should be enough of a quiz to jog your memory a little bit, keep you on your toes. So question number one, the most important goal to have is, what do you want? What do you want out of this? What are you doing this for? What is your number one priority? Why are you in this? That's your number one goal to have in mind when you're entering any negotiation. What do you want? If you don't know what you want out of it, then you're just mindlessly arguing with someone or communicating with them for no reason. Why are you doing it? Question number two. It was from this module, but you had to draw on a little bit of information from way back when, from modules and modules ago, to completely answer the question. All right, question number two was, if someone's responding to the sound of the screeching nails, of course, they're auditory. Auditory. And what kind of words would you want to use to control them or manipulate them or persuade them? You would use words such as, I hear what you're saying, or doesn't this sound like a good deal? Okay, so words that have to do with sound. Those are the words that you would use with that person. Very important, I can't emphasize it enough, very important to determine the major representational system of the person or the major modality, auditory, kinesthetic, or visual, and to work with that information. It's not good enough just to know it. You've got to work with it. Work with it in your texts to them, in your emails to them, in your letters to them, in your phone calls to them, and anytime they are communicated with, use their major representational system. Okay. So I'm certain that you did well on that quiz, and I'm certain that if you didn't, you will go back and review the information before carrying on. But let's go ahead and have some homework, some fun work. What I want you to do is the nails screeching down the chalkboard example. And I want you to pay attention to how that person is reacting or that group is reacting. Just find an excuse to talk about it. Afterwards, separate yourself from it. Say, I don't like that either. Because what you run the risk of if you don't separate yourself from it is someone who is associated with nails screeching down a blackboard. Suddenly, you're the nails screeching down the blackboard guy or girl. You don't want to be that person. They'll form a subconscious link. So separate yourself from that. Here's that, but that's the enemy, that screeching nail situation. I don't know anyone who likes screeching nails, but you need to find out why they're reacting that way. What is it? Is it the sight, the sound, or the feeling that they get inside? So describe it using all three, but slowly. First, you see the nails scraping down the chalkboard. Secondly, you hear that sound. Thirdly, you feel in your bones that nail scraping down the chalkboard feeling. So make it real. Make it real for them, but do each one slowly and watch after they respond and then separate yourself from it. By the way, let me separate myself from that now. I do not like nails scraping down a chalkboard. Okay. Hope you've had fun with this. I hope you have fun with the homework, with the fun work. And join me in the next module as we learn even more. I'm Steve G. Jones, clinical hypnotherapist, hoping you Have an outstanding day.